You're listening to Midori House, first broadcast on the 17th of May 2016 on Monocle 24. Hello and welcome to Midori House, coming to you live from Studio One here in London. I'm Tom Edwards. On today's show,
we'll support the Presidency Council as it seeks exemption from the UN arms embargo to acquire those weapons and bullets needed to fight Daesh and other terrorist groups.
The US is ready to arm Libya's new government in its fight against Islamic State militants, but has it been properly thought out? Also on the programme, we'll discuss a radical plan by Thai authorities to stop tourists damaging one of the country's most beautiful islands. And
we'll do anything for your smile, anything that's our style, anything for you. We're British, you know. We'll take more care of you.
British Airways could be about to stop giving away free food and drink to its short-haul passengers. Good business or a PR disaster? We'll find out. That's all ahead on Midori House with me, Tom Edwards. A warm welcome to Midori House. My guests today are Daniela Peled, Acting Managing Editor at the Institute for War and Peace Reporting, and Alistair Bunkle, Defence Correspondent at Sky News. Welcome both back to the programme. Good to have you with us. Let's start with the US Secretary of State, John Kerry. He says the US and other countries could arm Libya's new government to defeat Islamic State militants. Let's take a listen.
The international community will support the Presidency Council as it seeks exemption from the UN arms embargo to acquire those weapons and bullets needed to fight Daesh and other terrorist groups. We're not talking about troops and boots and that kind of intervention. We continue right now to assess the ISIL activity that's taking place, and we're working with our partners to determine the best way forward to help Libya to be able to deal with that threat.
John Kerry there. Tripoli's government says ISIS could seize swathes of the country if its advances aren't halted, but will providing them with arms prove a help or a hindrance? Let's kick things off with a nice, easy one. Alistair, who's in charge in Libya?
good question, and nobody is fully in charge. The GNA, the Government of National Accord, is the UN-backed government based in Tripoli, pretty much exclusively within a naval base, although it has made some small progress trying to take charge of a few national institutions. But, I mean, they might have the backing of the international community. They don't have the backing of their own country.
And what about this issue of arms then? Is it a simple question of, well, we can supply them to the right people and that's all approved, or is it going to cause more problems, and certainly in the medium term?
There are two undeniable things, I think, about Libya at the moment, unless Daniela disagrees with me. One is that it's in a complete mess, and the second is that it's awash with arms, left over from the Gaddafi regime and the fact that the borders between there and the rest of Africa are very loose and porous. I'm not sure Libya needs arms first and foremost. What it needs is support, and it needs coordination. It needs the various groups to work together against that common enemy, Daesh.
Daniela, presumably you do go along with that.
I do. I mean, certainly it is absolutely awash with arms. And the reasons for putting in place an arms embargo in 2011, because arms may fall into the wrong hands, are very much, you know, exactly the same conditions prevail. There's no guarantees that arms going to one actor are not going to, almost inevitable, that they will fall into the hands of another. Perhaps not the right sort of arms. Perhaps the Libyan army, such as it is, needs capacity and particularly focused areas. But it's not really just about ISIS either. I mean, if that was that would be that simple. We could all agree that they action needed to be taken against them. I mean, Libya needs a government. It needs one government, some form of government, because of course they're not the only group claiming to be legitimate rulers. There's another group in the east, which is saying, led by a chap called Haftar. He's saying, well, we are the government. We can look after it.
And he spent a lot of time in America in the past. So he's got quite a lot of friends, actually, in the United States, albeit not the one that they are backing at the moment.
He's got friends in the United States. The Egyptians aren't that, you know, they're not that keen on seeing him go anywhere because, obviously, for strategic reasons, they want to keep their border I mean, secure is perhaps the wrong word, but not completely anarchic is a better word. And also the West, and certainly the European governments, have got an interest here because they're looking forward to a time when hopefully a Libyan government that's actually working in some kind of way is going to help stop the flow of migrants into Europe. But this is slight fantasy at the moment. We're no way anywhere near that having, that being able to do that. But that's the long term. It's not just about saying, right, we're gonna act against ISIS, and it's as simple
as that.
Arm
you lot and not you lot. It's interesting, Alistair, one of the things that you've mentioned, and this is mentioned by everyone, and there seems to be broad agreement, and that's about giving infrastructure help, organisational support, these kind of words. But then if we bore down into what that actually looks like, it's all well and good saying, well, look, you know, the GNA, you know, needs to take control of various ministries, and it needs to be achieved with the backing of the international community. But how does that happen? Even if there are protagonists who have the right friends in America, it's not as easy as that, though, is it?
No, you need the personnel framework put in place. And this, we can link this back to the idea of giving arms to the Libyans. A couple of months ago, there was a lot of chat about sending a large Italian-led training mission to Libya with British help and probably help from some others like the French. I mean, we're talking to 6,000 or 7,000 here. As I understand it, quite recently, that's being scaled back quite considerably, but there will be some sort of help. Now, if you've got to train the army, the police, the Coast Guard, and they are not in a fit state to currently secure the country, secure the oil refineries, secure the seaports, the airports, the major ministries, the other national buildings in Libya, in Tripoli, in Sirte, and elsewhere, then who the hell are you arming? Because if they're not good enough to do that at the moment, that's the first stage, is getting them to a position where they are qualified, working together, and able to secure these places before you start giving them arms. I think it's the wrong way to approach it. I think it's upside down, if you like.
And Daniel, if that's true, if it's a wrong-headed or an upside down or a back to front approach, what prospect of, you know, the right course of action being set anytime soon? And if it's going to be set, who's going to set it?
Well, the problem with the right course of action, I think we're looking at the least wrong course of action. Mm. I mean, all of the options have got their negative points, and I think if the UN are going to back a leader, if they can say, right, Siraj is our guy, we've got to stick with him, then they have to put in place some measures for which he will be able to govern. And the problem, again, another problem, I mean, it's very easy to come with problems rather than solutions, but another issue is that he has no legitimacy domestically, and masses of military support from outside is only going to make him seem less legitimate. But the problem is, without that support, and I agree absolutely about the training, without that, then there's nothing he can do. Absolutely nothing.
The Libyans don't want international support. I mean, that's a generalisation, but the Libyans do not want an intervention. They don't want large numbers of foreign troops on the ground. They want to rule their own country. But the problem for the international community is one of time. Mm-hmm. You've got 3,000 or 4,000, at latest estimates, Islamic State fighters around Sirte, pretty secure. How long do you leave that for? Because if they continue to gain momentum and build, you then have yourself a problem similar to Syria, where it's too big a problem to solve relatively straightforward with the country that you have in place. And so you've got to have that balance. At what point do you go, well, we're not going to wait for the Libyans to sort themselves out. We've got to hit Islamic State before it's too late.
And how much is that old chestnut, Daniela, of sort of political short-termism, if you like, from some of these Western or the external actors a factor? Obviously, you've got, if we look to the US, you know, who knows where we're going to be by year's end, or certainly by the start of 2017, in terms of who's calling the shots. Is it a problem that people aren't invested in making decisions that might involve training or thinking about a military long view over, you know, 5-10 years even? Because, frankly, they're probably not going to be around then, so they're not bothered.
Well, the lack of a long view is sort of how we got into this mess in the first place, because of the intervention, which at the time, and perhaps still now, I think was a good idea, because the alternative would have been much, much worse. But it was a complete failure to plan for the next day. Intervention, by its nature, is always short term. You need to prepare the ground for aid workers, international community, and NGOs to come in and help rebuild the country with local support. But for that, you need the absolute minimum of security. And security institutions can be built from very little. I mean, thinking of the situation in Afghanistan, a country that I'm quite familiar with, and the Afghan National Army is by no means a world leader in every sphere. But after long effort, there is an institution, and it has been able to do things like secure, to an impressive extent, the elections, for instance. Mm.
But you had a proper international intervention there.
And it took a long time.
Neither the Libyans want, nor does the international community want to do in Libya. So, I mean, you and I both travel around Kabul many times. You see foreign troops travelling around in armoured vehicles. You see foreign troops guarding ministries, green zone buildings, etc. And that's what they want to avoid in Tripoli. So how do you avoid doing that, but at the same time have the same effect?
And presumably not a decade and change, whatever it is later.
So how do you achieve both? How do you achieve that balance of not going in visibly?
I'm not sure that you can. And I think this is what we're dancing around in every single forum, saying how do we manage to bring peace, to bring security, to stop the rise of Islamic State, but we're not going to put our troops on the ground, we're not going to put boots on the ground, and we're not we haven't found a solution in any field, I don't think, yet.
So maybe some intractable problems, but it's interesting if we go back to what we were hearing from John Kerry at the top of the programme, that we broadly agree maybe this seems like a fairly bad idea. Why is John Kerry saying it? Has he just made a misjudgment? Do we just think he's wrong, but he's trying his best? How else would you sort of explain his seeming enthusiasm for this latest idea?
I think they want to get the ball rolling a bit. I think it has taken longer than they expected to even get to this stage. If they manage to lift the UN arms embargo temporarily, which they would manage to do because so many of the UN Security Council nations are involved in this, then it depends what the sort of arms package is. I mean, I think there are a lot of what ifs here, and I'm skirting around the issue, but arms to Libya is a nice catch-all phrase, but it might be very small scale. It might just open the doors to other help that they could bring, that help they might want to be involved in, and that is the sort of things that we're talking about, like training missions.
Well, Alistair also makes a very good point in that this is a real rare moment of apparent international unity. The Security Council agrees on this. I mean, since when did they agree? When was the last time they agreed on something of this nature? So I think that's one good reason why.
North Korea.
there's always something. Just very briefly on IS, we talk about, the threat of them taking swathes of territory. People talk about, we could end up with IS, inverted commas, controlling Libya. Is that a plausible notion? Is it a coherent enough group to actually be running a state in that kind of way?
I don't know. On the one hand, they've sought, and quite successfully, some pretty decent refuge in and around Sirte, and they've managed to expand there, both through the flow of fighters, particularly from Tunisia as well, because that border is very weak. You've got a lot of young, disaffected, unemployed Tunisians looking for a better life. So they've been going to the first place that they reach, and that is Libya. But you've got an awful lot of competing tribal politics in Libya that won't necessarily allow Islamic State to have the sort of foothold that maybe they've had in Syria, at least without a much bigger fight.
Let's move on, and we'll talk a bit more actually about Islamic State in a moment or two. The New York Times reports that a number of Al-Qaeda veterans have been sent to Syria, apparently with the intention of establishing an emirate. US and European intelligence officials believe Al-Qaeda has been having a tough old time of it in Pakistan, and it plans to set up an alternate headquarters in Syria, maybe using its affiliate, the Al-Nusra Front. Daniela, how much of a problem is this? I guess... to talk of fronts on two fronts. One, a proximity to Europe, or a closer proximity to Europe, or maybe we shouldn't look at everything through that prism. And secondly, this proximity to these other countries that are acting as, recruitment centres of types for other fighters, whether it's Iraq, Lebanon, Jordan, Turkey even. Should we be worried?
Well, I think we should be worried about anything going on in this region. And one prospect this throws up is two sort of rival Islamic states fighting over resources and fighting over who can be the most brutal and who can be the most effective in recruitment. I mean, it's sad to say, really, but Al-Qaeda has had to up its game, because Islamic State is a much sexier proposition for many of the internationals flocking there, although it's very hard to tell how many people who travel to Syria end up fighting for Islamic State or fighting for Al-Nusra. But ideologically, they're very, very different. They have some ideals they agree on, but the whole of the Islamic State's legitimacy is about territorial control, about actually creating a functioning sort of state with school system, hospitals and so on, whereas Al-Qaeda has always put that prospect off to some other future time. So it would be a radical shift in its policies, in its outlook.
And what about the rhetoric, Alistair? I mean, talking about establishing an emirate, obviously there are sort of semantic questions here to some degree, but is that just, okay, it's rhetoric, it's looking at some kind of, a rebrand, if you like, of the sort of AEQ sort of group? Or is that an actual plan? Is there something more concrete and coherent than we should be worried about?
I think there's real dangers in them trying to establish, dangers for themselves trying to establish some sort of caliphate, not only because you've got Islamic State who are trying to do exactly the same, but the more you try and do that in Syria, the more they might alienate people who at the moment might have a similar cause to them, and those are people who are anti-Assad. Look, I must say, intelligence agencies, the word sort of on the street, if you like, within security circles, for some time has been, do not ignore al-Nusra Front, the al-Qaeda affiliate in Syria. They have been worried for months and months that Islamic State gets the headlines and for the moment is the greatest threat to the West, but quietly and very assuredly, al-Nusra Front has been building quite a solid base in Syria. And the difference between the two, I mean, there are many differences between the two, as Daniela was saying, but Islamic State, if you're of that mind, is quite a sexy prospect, if you like. But the fighters are very young, often pretty naive, and don't quite know what they're getting into. What Al-Qaeda and Nusra Front presents you with is the thinking man's jihad, if you like. And that's where they are attracting a lot of their bases from, people who are in it for a much longer-term haul.
And that's interesting. You mentioned this idea about this has been the talk in intelligence circles. Is it a warning that is or has been and is indeed now being paid heed to?
Yeah, no, I'm not sure it is. I haven't heard or come across much in any people I've spoken from many people I've spoken to in government, if you like, that is where policy is heading. If the intelligence agencies are right, then they're going to have to address it at some point because Islamic State will be wiped out or degraded to such a point that it doesn't pose an existential threat and will probably, of course, morph into something else. This idea that you can never actually get rid of an ideology, you can just kind of push it away elsewhere. And so Al-Qaeda will rise. And I think Al-Qaeda know that. I think that's what they are looking at. Mm-hmm. There was a little bit early on in the coalition campaign against the Khorasan group, which was another AQ affiliate. The Russians have been going at Nusra Front a bit. But on the whole, the attention has been on Islamic State.
Daniel, I wanted to ask you, it strikes me we're talking about, sexy propositions, and I know Charles Lister wrote in Foreign Policy that this could be a confidence boost for the AQ brand, and we talk about brands and, who's selling themselves. Is this the right way to try and understand these kind of groups? Do you think it's an error to use, I guess we're talking almost, management speak and very, Western sort of business mantras to describe them. Is that an error or is it as helpful a way as any other?
I don't think it's an error at all, because that's the way groups describe themselves, and that is the recruiting tactics. And, some of the most effective, I think, anti-Islamic State actions, propaganda, have been coming from, on the ground in Iraq and Syria itself, people ridiculing them on social media, because it is, it is all about the sort of a sexy prospect that's attracting young men from around the world. You look at their propaganda videos and so on and so forth. So it seems somehow distasteful, but I don't think there's an awful amount of, Islamic jurisprudence as part of their ideology or the pseudo-nation building that they're doing. As far as al-Nusra go, I think they seem to be a little less slick when it comes to outreach. But also, crucially, they've shown perfect willingness to work with other groups, even the supposedly secular groups, and cooperate with them when it comes to things on the ground in Syria, like running school systems and transport and rubbish collection and Sharia courts that operate in conjunction with civil courts. And that, I think, in the short term, means that life is a little bit more stable. In the long term, it's perhaps a little bit more dangerous.
Well, I did actually want to ask Alistair, you about this. And it struck me when we were talking about Libya about, you know, how are the different groups that are attempting to establish governments actually selling their ideas? You know, are they actually managing to administer any of the functions of state to people? And similarly here, you know, within Syria, how well are any of these groups doing in actually, you know, speaking to the public, if you like, delivering any kind of services, showing that they can collaborate or function in any kind of coalition way? Or is there just simply not really the means for them to even begin to try and demonstrate that?
No, I think the means exist in certain places. You take life in even Raqqa, Islamic State's so-called headquarters, and it's very hard to tell because none of us can get access to it. But people who can sort of see it in other ways, maybe through sort of drone footage, if you like, continuous drone footage, would suggest that actually, to some degree, life continues as normal. I mean, not completely as normal, but life functions. My experience sometimes of the general public in these situations is that they will often go with who is strongest, maybe who's wealthiest, who offers them a continuation of their life, if you like. We saw it in Afghanistan a lot as well. You know, at the end of the day, one of the tactics for the British and the Americans was, if we can offer them a better life, they will prefer us over the Taliban. It's quite straightforward like that. A lot of people's horizons stretch little further than their towns, their villages, the desire to put food on the table for their families. It comes down to those basics. But then when you're talking about the influx of Western foreign fighters, again, probably a similar modus operandi applies. If you're bigger, badder, better, and you get your message out there, then you're probably likely to be where they flock to.
The insights of Alistair Bunkle, Daniela Pellet here as well on Midori House. Coming up next, Thailand's radical plans to protect one of the country's most popular and beautiful islands, and could BA be about to end free food and drink for its customers on short-haul flights? Stay tuned.
Who are the young designers you should be looking out for? Who's leading the way when it comes to architecture, fashion, product and interior design? And what lessons from design history should we all be taking note of?
He really was an artist whose medium of expression was fashion.
I could never live in a place that I designed because I'm not designing for myself.
You look for where there is a potential for creativity, for poetry. So architectural lighting, where the dialogue with architecture can become something very interesting.
Monocle 24's design programme Section D delves deep into the places, communities and manufacturers that make the design industry what it is. From trade shows to trend forecasts, tune in every Tuesday and make Section D the object of your attention.
Minutes past the hour exactly here in London. Thai authorities say that one of their most popular islands has been ruined by the number of tourists visiting it each year, so they're closing it indefinitely. The Bangkok Post reports that officials are worried that heavy tourism is negatively affecting natural resources and the environment of Koh Tuk Chai. Still with me, Daniela Pellet and Alistair Bunkle. Alistair, what does this tell us most about? Does it say something about Thailand and its way of dealing with an influx of tourists, a very valuable commodity indeed? Or does it tell us more about said tourists and their willingness or otherwise to, I don't know, take a step out into the unknown?
Surely it's a backhanded compliment for Thailand, right? I mean, it says that it's so popular that it actually, that's become something of a problem. I think this is great news. I have been lucky enough to go to Thailand and visit its beaches. I don't know whether you guys have, and they are beautiful. They are absolutely wonderful, and they are a little slice of paradise. But I read somewhere that beaches on this island that are supposed to have a capacity of 70 often had as many as 1,000 people on them, food stalls, tourist boats.
That's quite dense.
It sounds horrid. I mean, why would you go to a paradise beach that is so small it can only take 70?
Sounds like Tenerife or Magaluf. Why bother?
But why not close it? Why not close them? Allow the ecosystem to restore itself.
And what about the local people? The local people setting up their stalls and like selling fish to all these rich lobster-red Western tourists.
Well, that is the problem. You know, what happens to the tourism industry? Because I'm sure a lot of people... I didn't see that written anywhere, actually, in relation to this story. It was the Bangkok Post, I think, first reported it. But what happens to the people who rely on tourism on that island? I mean, maybe it is one of the smaller islands that doesn't have any inhabitants. Maybe you go there on day trips. I don't know. I haven't actually been to that one myself. But
I think it's. I mean, I think it's also a good idea, and perhaps even a cynical idea regarding country branding, because, you know, Thailand can now say, look what we're doing. We care about our nature. We're protecting it. We're closing this entire island down. Well, you know, there are a lot of islands and there are a lot of beaches, and it allows the government to make a gesture towards environmentalism. And I mean, tourism is its lifeblood. You know, there's not going to be, nothing would happen. No government decision would make a genuine impact. I mean, and quite frivolously, I kind of wish we could do the same in parts of London. Is that awful?
Well, no, I was going to ask you, I mean, in terms of avoiding these hotspots, you're both rather well travelled yourselves. Is the fact that somewhere is very popular a disincentive when you go and visit? So, I mean, I don't know. Do you sort of deliberately avoid places where you're going to run into?
The reason you go somewhere that is popular, or the reason people go to somewhere that is popular, is because it has something to offer, right? And so I guess you kind of want to see that. But then at the same time, there's nothing better than escaping to, I don't know, somewhere really quiet, like the west coast of Scotland or somewhere rural in Italy or
France.
Not sure
we're, capturing the same demographic.
No, I know, but I'm just trying to think of somewhere isolated where you can go and have some quiet time. But then if you want to go to New York or you want to go to central London, then you kind of got to expect the crowds.
I do. I think a close second is actually having the ability to moan about the times when you used to visit Venice and you used to visit the Duomo in Florence and you didn't have to queue. And that's something quite satisfying about that.
Look, I work just around the corner from the Houses of Parliament, and it's the state opening of Parliament tomorrow. So all the roads are shut off. And whilst it's a fantastic place to work, you do get a little bit fed up with having to dodge the tourists. I must have photobombed so many tourist gnats. And yet today, lovely and calm, and you can walk down the middle of the road.
So we're advocating more closures and more widely. That's basically what we're saying.
For people who are not us.
Exactly. Very good. Well, let's move on. We're still in sort of travel and transport realm. Let's take a listen to this.
We'll do anything for your smile, anything. That's our style, anything for you. We're British, you know. We'll take more care of you.
Well, they will indeed. Or maybe they won't for much longer. British Airways has given away free food and drink for all its economy class customers for decades. But there are suggestions. Alex Cruz, who took over as chairman and chief exec at BA last month, may do away with it. At the moment, it's just being considered for short-haul flights, reportedly. But even the long-haul freebies could be up for review. What do you make of this, Daniela? Is it a changing of the guard, the end of an era, something we should worry about, or perhaps not?
Well, I think the days when British Airways could say they were the highest service airline are long gone. I'm afraid to say the last BA flight I took a few weeks ago to Beirut, the food was absolutely filthy and depressingly so. And the best thing on my tray was a piece of individually wrapped, like Somerset cheddar or something. It was a British cheese, and I thought, well, that's quite good. I would be quite happy just to forego the hot food and sort of filthy salads and everything, and just have like Ploughman's, you know, and you could have cold food, a bit of British
traditional British fare.
And that would, you know, provide the message, you know, this is a classy airline, and probably save quite a lot of money as well.
What do you think, Alistair?
It's an awful idea. I fly British Airways quite a bit. I tend to sort of... I mean, they're not literally the national flag carrier anymore, but they kind of are. They carry the British flag. They carry the British name. I know times are tough in the aviation industry, but I'm sure that going back to the sort of the basics of good customer service is the way forward. You don't have to be the Ryanairs and the EasyJets, which in their own right are very successful. But nor does it have to be a race to the bottom. And I similarly came back from the Middle East on British Airways quite recently, and the food wasn't that good either. And you know what I would do? Have you ever travelled first class on British Airways?
This is a leading question.
I won't let you answer. I would send a few journalists like us up to first class to see what it's like and to give them positive PR.
I support wholeheartedly.
And what about the gent we heard from in the promotional materials? I think BA is missing a trick. We need to go back to some of that as well. Bit old school.
Virgin did that brilliant advert to celebrate 25 years when they went back to the... they did everything from the 1980s, and it was genius.
That sort of affable old gent. I'd pretty much do whatever he told me.
And all the staff as well.
Yeah. Yep. Lovely stuff. There we must leave it. Thanks both for your insights today. Daniela Pellad and Alistair Bunkle, thank you very much for being our guests here on Midori House. That's all we have time for. Today's programme was produced by Rhys James, researched by Fernando Augusto Pacheco and Maria Granina, and our studio manager was Toby Hammond. More music on the way next. 1900 here in London is Section D with Henry Rhys Sheridan, looking at the importance of the humble chair. And we'll have more in the day's big stories.
Light and Shade 2 on the Monocle Daily, 2200 London time. Midori House is back at the same time tomorrow, 1800 hours here in London. From me, Tom Edwards, and all the Tuesday team, thank you very much indeed for tuning in. Goodbye.